Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is the New Books in Science, Technology, and Society podcast. Welcome to the channel, and thanks very much for joining me. I just finished talking with Sabine Arnaud about her new book, On Hysteria, The Invention of a Medical Category Between 1670 and 1820, and this came out with the University of Chicago Press in 2015. Now, what the book does is take this really, really interesting case study of hysteria and use it to explore a number of kinds of issues that aren't necessarily only local to hysteria, but allow us to open up into some really interesting considerations of methodology, of the historiography of science and medicine, of the way that writing creates and is created by bodies, of writing genres, and a whole lot more. So right in the preface, what Sabine does is lays out at least some of the issues that the study allows us to explore. And I want to just give you a sense of some of them as a kind of introduction to lead us into the conversation. So studying hysteria, according to the book, allows us to consider issues that include, on the one hand, the role played by language in the definition of any medical category, and the book really pays very careful and very special attention to written medical genres and also written genres that aren't explicitly kind of calling attention to themselves as medical in order to consider narrative strategies and other kinds of discursive and writing strategies that are responsible for the emergence and transformations of this pathological category. It also looks at, on the other hand, I'm actually going to give you lots of different hands. So imagine as I'm talking, a body with many, many hands. So on another hand, the way that hysteria becomes a category in a larger context of the increasing importance of categories as objects. It also looks at, on yet another hand, in our many-handed body, the way that hysteria kind of underwent transformations in accordance with the political and the religious contexts and interests of the authors who are writing about it in these very different genres across the time period that Sabine is writing about. It also looks, on yet another hand, at the relationship between the transformations of understanding hysteria as a pathology and transformations in the way modernity was conceptualized and encountered. And this is in particular in light of the French Revolution. And there's some really interesting material that you'll get to at the end of the book and the end of our conversation to come that looks at the ways that changes in the way that writers were thinking about modernity, the nation, and women's bodies in particular are also evoking transformations in this category of hysteria as a pathology. There's also some really interesting attention to the way that doctors are manipulating writings about hysteria as a way to empower themselves, to create a space for the doctors and their power and their role in the transforming social, political, and religious landscapes that Sabine is looking at. So there's a lot here. It's a really rich study. It's I think, required reading for anybody who's interested in and working on 18th century medicine and science. And it's also got a picture on the cover, or a series of pictures on the cover, of a device that I will refer to in this medium as a colander dildo. And once you get a copy of the book and see what I'm talking about, you will know what I mean. So on that note, I will let you get to the conversation, but thank you so much as ever for your support of the channel, for listening, and I hope you enjoy. I'm here today to talk with Sabine Arnaud about her new book, On Hysteria. Welcome to the New Books in Science, Technology, and Society podcast, Sabine, and thanks so much for making time to talk with me today. I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, thank you, Carla. I'm really excited to be with you today.
So, Sabine, let's start, as is kind of traditional for the channel, by saying a little bit, or by talking a little bit about how you came to the field, and specifically, what brought you to the history of science and medicine as a discipline?
Well, actually, I discovered this field really, really late. I mean, I had been reading Michel Foucault very early on, but without associating, you know, the history of madness or other of his works on medicine with a field. And I first studied art history, then aesthetics and philosophy. And then I went to the US to do a PhD in comparative literature. So just quite a long trajectory. And when I was at the time of doing my dissertation, I wanted to work on the 18th century. And one of the things that fascinated me in the 18th century was the fact that it was that this relationship between body and mind was constantly highlighted by writers such as Diderot and many others. And I was also really excited by the fact that it was a very interdisciplinary time. I mean, more exactly a pre-disciplinary time, you know, where men of letters read philosophy, medicine, novels, and write all along these formats and these fields. And while reading Diderot, I was wondering what you know, all these categories such as vapors hysteric fits and suffocation were coming along so much. And I suddenly discovered that they were also used by all these doctors who were also publishing very, very exciting texts of art and texts worthy of, you know, a literary reading. And so this actually led me to the field of history of science. You know, I did it the other way around. And so then starting my dissertation, I suddenly discovered there was all these fields I had to tackle with. And so this was a journey because it was just from a discovery to many others.
You know, I think that's actually not an uncommon experience for a lot of us, right? We find our way to this field not knowing initially that it even exists and kind of exploring our way there. So that actually makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
The book that we're talking about today focuses on hysteria, right? The subtitle is The Invention of a Medical Category Between 1670 and 1820. So Sabine, what brought you to this particular focus for the book? Why hysteria? How did you come here?
I mean, I guess while reading these texts from the 18th century, I was fascinated that so much attention had been brought to hysteria in the 19th century, and that I was already seeing this category before, and that very, very few scholars had talked about that. But not only that, but the fact that it was a totally, totally, totally different category at the time, and that it was used in ways that would be totally forgotten in the 19th century. And so it seemed that there was there not only one, but many, many, many different usages of the word and of the topic and of these political effects and of its impact for both understanding the 18th century and the move towards the 19th century after the French Revolution, or in England, the political moves as well. And that so much was there. So it was actually then quite a challenge to encompass that in one book. But that was also what I really wanted, to bring all that together and see that we had to deal with all these interpretations at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So the book explores a history of discursive practices that played a role in constructing hysteria as a pathology. And it asks and answers a major question. What made it possible, this is in the words of the book, to view dozens of different diagnoses as variants of a single pathology, hysteria? And you offer us, I think, a really, really rich way of thinking about this. And I think a way of thinking about and practicing the history and the genealogy of this pathology and this kind of set of ways of thinking about and writing about this pathology in a way that's kind of a model moving forward as well. One of the answers that the book offers, and this is again in the words of the book, is that one of the things that made it possible is a long process of a rewriting and negotiation over the definition of these diagnoses, which enabled this retrospective assimilation, which was driven, in the words of the book, by enormously diverse political and epistemological stakes. So this is just to lay a bit of foundation for listeners. Now, throughout the book, and now let's just kind of dive into the introduction, right? Throughout the book, one of the things that emerges immediately and exists as a thread throughout is the importance of studying writing practices. Sometimes in the book, you refer to these as enunciations, but throughout, the importance of genres of writing, of practices of writing, including non-medical, or what we might think of as a non-medical writing corpus, is absolutely central, or seems at least to me to be absolutely central to what you're arguing in the book. So let's start by talking about that. What brought you here in this study to a focus on writing? For you, what made it... Or, well, can you just talk about that? Like, for you, how did you come to identify this as such a central part of what was happening in your study?
Yeah, sure. Thank you for the question. I mean, I think that there were different reasons. I mean, one was literally the fascination that I experience that I felt while reading some of these books, such as the one from Huneau or from Révillon, where I thought this is such a fantastic, you know, piece of writing by itself, you know. But what made it then particularly important, and the reason why I gave it such a space within the book, is the fact that I realized that for this category to be established, actually none of the interpretative link that had been offered was enough. I mean, and this is in a way what the chapter one deconstruct by going through three main interpretation and three main contexts of usage of hysteria. I mean, one being a way to distinguish class and see and distinguish the aristocracy from and the pathologies of the aristocracy from others, one to distinguish between genders and one to distinguish between religious pathologies and a reinterpretation of conversion and mystical and feats from coming from experiences of ecstasy or so. And that none of these interpretation was enough to explain all hysteria became and such a category that could encompass so many different interpretation and contexts that it was why by studying the uses of citations, the way all these texts refer to some authors, refer to some short narratives, referred to a common use of language and of a tradition that one could see and trace really what this fantastic creation of a word and of a medical category, and then this led me even further to analyze really what was so particular about 18th century medicine, which in a way, I mean, I see hysteria as an exemplary case of a category of medical diagnosis in the 18th century. The 18th century has been a little bit left on the side in terms of medicine. It's often looked at as, you know, a century which didn't bring discoveries such as the 19th century and which can be a bit forgotten, that maybe things start with Mesmer as a first step towards psychoanalysis, but that before, you know, there's nothing happening. And so what I tried to show is that with this use of writing practices, there was a creation of this complicity with the patient and in a way something very close to what has been emphasized in the last 30 years as something very important, which is to let the patient talk, to give importance to what he says, to encourage patients to write their own narrative and to create this way access for the doctor to a wealth of information that had been left on the side in the 19th and early 20th century as unnecessary in an era of objective knowledge. So there are writing practices come at many, have many, many layers for me.
Great. Thank you so much. Now, sort of getting into chapter one, since you've kind of already really beautifully brought us into that context, one of the points that you make here was that the term hysteria didn't actually come into use by a number of physicians in France until the 1760s. And it was only invoked, as you call it, in earnest at the turn of the 19th century. So this actually raises a really fascinating methodological kind of problem or opportunity, right? Or certainly something that I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about, given what you were just talking about. So given this multiplicity of kinds of things that people were talking about and kinds of ways that they were enunciating that in this period you're looking at, how did you as an author identify and also curate this range of materials and terms and discussions that you're going to incorporate here? Sort of put another way, how did you decide what to bring into your archive and what was relevant, given the fact that not everyone was using this terminology hysteria?
Yes, that was one of the challenges of the book, indeed, because if you read a description of tetanus or of ergo in the 18th century, you will see some of the symptoms. And since in the 18th century, there is no proper list of symptoms for hysteria, what could be part of, what was not going to be part of. And so I considered mostly what was the function of these texts, in which way did they insert themselves in a series of texts, which text did they respond to or reply to, and which text did they recognize as part of the same research, part of the same foundational research of a new category. And since 18th century doctors tend to quote a lot and establish their authority by referring to other doctors, I could reconstitute this link between doctors and see which texts are that themselves selected. My main, I would say that my main methodological commitment there was to forget anything that had been written on hysteria after 1820 and to really start from what do these physicians, men of letters, philosophers, narrators look for? What are they interested in themselves? What do they link these historic fits to? And no matter if afterwards this would play a role or not, the important thing for me was not to look for what had been identified later on in the 19th century or in the 20th century as hysteria.
So it sounds like, in a really interesting way, a kind of practice of forgetting was part of your methodology.
Right.
Which is interesting. I love that. So you very recently, or just kind of a few minutes ago, mentioned these three threads that the first chapter takes us through, right? The construction of a female illness, an approach to pathology that established the role of a social class, and also a medical interpretation of what are called fits, and we'll talk about those later, that was proposed in a religious context. So I'd like to ask you to talk about just a couple of these as a way to open this up for our listeners. How did, so let's take on class specifically, mm-hmm. and you talk about this. Can you talk a little bit about the way that social class, and specifically an association of hysteria with the aristocratic class, as you've just mentioned, come into the picture? What's important for us to understand about the connection between hysteria and the aristocracy at this point of the story, in order to lay a foundation that you think is important for what's to come?
I think that one of the things that I depict in the book is, in a way, the complicity between doctors and members of the aristocracy. In France, the king Louis XIV was depicted as vaporous, as having fits of melancholy, bouts of melancholy. George III in England was also presented as having these hysteric fits. And many writers at the time already start making fun about the fact that the aristocracy wants to have the same pathology as the king. And and so they make even more fun of the bourgeois who want to imitate the aristocracy and try to emulate them and reconstitute the life of the court in their own little salon. And so there is this idea that the pathology of the king becomes a model for everyone in his desire to be as close as possible to the king. On the other hand, what is also important is that doctors in the 18th century were trying to get their entry in the aristocracy. These were also a way for doctors from the provinces in France to come to Paris or to Versailles. Their diplomas were not allowing them to do so unless an aristocrat would ask them to come. So we can see also this category as a chance. I mean, in these writings about hysteric fit, as a chance for them to create a relationship, to initiate a relationship with members of the aristocracy. And while their writing will address the sensibility of aristocrats, to show them that they are ready to understand them and to support them in their illness.
Now, another really interesting thread here that you talk about is this thread of religion. And specifically, the chapter considers, this is chapter one, the link between hysteria and ideas of possession. Now, one of the things that's happening here that's really interesting from the perspective of historiography or methodology is that you're making a point here or asking us to think about the connection between hysteria and religion or the relationship to religious contexts in a way that's quite different from what some readers and some writers have come to this topic assuming. So can you talk a little bit about the significance of the religious context here and its connection with hysteria? How, if you are thinking about it in this way, how is your approach to situating hysteria within a religious context importantly different from what some other scholars are doing?
I mean, one of the things that really interested me was to see that this medical prism had taken over a religious prism, but that it had been mostly used, and this partly following Dussertu and Foucault, at a certain point with a complicity between the church and who came to see doctors so that they would diagnose, asked to support, invited the doctors into convents so that they would see if any of these diabolic manifestations, so-called diabolic manifestation, were actually pathological ones. But further into this research, discovering all into specific crises such as Jansenism. I mean, I could have written also about the French prophets. I'm not doing it here because this book would have become enormous if I had to talk about everything in the 18th century where hysteria was used. But Jansenists having pathological fits on the tomb of on de Paris were reinterpreted as having bouts of hysteria or of melancholy, of nervous illness, effect of sympathy, and all this was a political tool to discredit Jansenism at a moment when Jansenism was attracting more and more people from all classes who were gathering in Paris, in first on the tomb of the Paris and afterwards in hidden places. So, and this went so far as having religious Jansenist people write about these moments and these thoughts, saying, no, these are not hysteric fits, and this is why. So that they, in their report about those experiences of ecstasy, of those experiences of convulsions, were integrating those interpretations from doctors to contradict them.
Great. Thank you so much. Now, if we move from here, as we move from here to the next chapter, we move into a really interesting exploration of the role of images and of metaphor to what's going on here. So you make a point here in chapter 2 that definitions of hysteria were inadequate, like definitions themselves, for the purpose of the physicians that you're talking about here. And so physicians, in order to talk about this and communicate about this, were relying instead on images and on metaphors. And you talk about the importance of images of rural animals, images of dogs and of wolves, and you take us through a catalog of metaphors and images that became associated with these diagnoses. So the image of Proteus, the image of a chameleon, and the image of a hydra receive especially close study here, and they're really fascinating. These three metaphors, as you show, the Proteus, chameleon, and hydra, bound together texts from 1575 to 1820 around a similar diagnosis. So there's this really interesting use and treatment of metaphor as a kind of binding device. So what I want to do is just kind of hit the ball back to you and ask you to talk a little bit about this. So just to kind of open up, can you say a little bit about what was inadequate for physicians in these definitions, and why were metaphors so useful and so important? What kind of work did these metaphors do for these physicians in their practice as kind of writers and diagnosers?
Yes, thank you. I think that what's very striking indeed about in many of these writing from doctors is that they start their treatises by saying, we cannot define hysteria. And so hysteria is from the outset presented as the pathology that cannot be defined. And this precisely in an era, the 18th century, that really wants to define. I mean, we're at the time of the encyclopedia, of the creation and the publication of many, many dictionaries, of also the first dictionaries of medicine. So we're at a time where, you know, creating categories and diagnoses and new diagnoses and defining them is really one of the important activity. And here they start by saying, no, this is not possible. And sometimes you can sense a bit of frustration also, because this forces them to move out of what they see themselves to be expected to do, right? And what gathers many of these texts, and what also allows and has allowed me to trace a link between these texts, is this need and this desire to provide an image or that will give a sense of the illness, and that will convey also the emotional impact of watching an hysteric patient or an hysteric person, and give the reader what a effect of surprise, of fear, of outstanding emotion can provoke a body which is which can appear just seem dead because it's without any strength and lying down and seem not to breathe, or on the contrary having unexpected force and incredible violence when this is a frail body of a young woman and that nothing seemed to prepare her to react. So I think that these images have really contributed in giving and in creating the characteristic of this pathology, and in marking the imagination of the readers, possibly of the patients themselves, and of the physician, as they taught each other, as they taught their students about this category.
Great. So in this chapter, not only is metaphor a really important discursive device here, but also what's one of the things that's really striking here is the importance of repetition to the making of a discourse. So you talk specifically here about the significance of repetition in terms of repeated quotations, and you take us specifically into the use of a reference to Plato's Timaeus that, as you're showing here, creates continuity among very different kinds of texts. But in general, since the book so beautifully brings out the importance of these discursive devices throughout the chapters, not just here, but also elsewhere, it's striking how much repetition becomes such an important kind of tool of art for the making of this discourse. So can you talk a little bit about that, sort of the importance of repetition, maybe repeated quotation in this context, but for you even more generally, the significance of that as a craft here?
Yes, I think indeed that it is a very important element in the creation of the category. And this, in a way, the creation itself, the first appearance of a diagnosis, whichever it is, and in this particular case of the word hysteria, is not what makes it important. What makes it important is that it's going to be used and reused in many contexts. So there is... I would say, indeed, as you suggest in your question, there is the repetition of certain references and certain quotes that doctors will use and cite from each other and reuse and displace while displacing sometimes their meaning. But there is also, very importantly for the book, this idea that it is through its repetition that this category became established. And because we can see it through medical writing, philosophical writing, political pamphlets, correspondences, any kind of text, that in this repetition, the importance of the category becomes established, but the meaning constantly changed. So we are in this double tendency, one of establishment and one of multiplication, of multiplicity of meaning, constant diversification of its possibilities, of its connotations, and also then of its denotations.
Wonderful. Thank you. So as we move from this to the next chapter, we move into a chapter that takes us back into the engagement between hysteria and an aristocratic audience, specifically by looking at a range of literary genres that physicians were using and also adapting in order to present this pathology to this particular kind of audience. And you take us through several of these genres, and they include dialogue, autobiography, letters of different sorts. So you both look at fictional correspondence, sort of writers who are imitating fiction writers of the era, and also consultations that are happening between patients and physicians through letters, and also anecdotes. Okay, so what I'd like to kind of open up here are at least a couple of these genres to kind of give listeners a sense of their importance. Now, you argue here throughout this chapter that these genres are helping to shape a new image of the physician, and this is a new image as the physician as somebody who is close to his patients. And as you say here, in the words of the book, these genres helped shape this image of the physician, not only the physician, but also a pathology that was an effect of sensibility, an effect of an aristocratic way of life. Okay, so that's the groundwork. So let's get into some of the details. Now, for me, one of the more fascinating genres that you're looking at here is the genre of a dialogue. Dialogues were common in the 16th and 17th centuries for treatises on rhetoric and for treatises on kind of fashionable topics at court. And one of the things that's really interesting here about the dialogue, I think, and this is totally idiosyncratic, right? But I'm really interested in the way that you're showing the relationship of the dialogue to kind of ways of conveying dynamics, the dynamics of relationships, the rhythm of knowledge, as you kind of put it at one point. So I just love to hear you talking a little bit about this. How did medical writers use the genre of the dialogue? And for you, what's most interesting about that? And perhaps more broadly, for you, what's most interesting about the ways that they're using these genres kind of more generally in this context?
Right. Thank you. Yeah, I think that one of the things that was for me very exciting while reading these texts was the ways they give a space for the patient and in which they create a patient and give tools to their potential patient to talk about their own body. By giving a space, by giving this voice to someone who wouldn't, who don't have the knowledge of the doctor, but yet is making suggestions to the doctor, is bringing out descriptions that are helpful to the doctor to talk about the body, who challenges the doctor with his own impression, with her own experience of the illness. There is a space which is created. There is a space which is created not only for the doctor and his colleagues, not only the doctor and scientist, but for all those who are interested by the illness, all those that are fascinated by the pathology, all those that experience or have the idea that at any moment in their life they have seen or experienced the pathology, and that any can contribute. Because what becomes really important at that point is the particularity of the disease, the way that it can take so many shapes. And there, all are invited to bring their idea of the pathology. So I think that was, for me, very fascinating to see how the challenge this way, a certain idea of medicine as being remote from the patient, how they use strategically the move towards the vernacular and invite a contribution from all and can get close to the patient.
Fabulous. Thank you so much. And there's a bunch of material in this chapter that we won't have time to talk about in any detail, but I just want to let listeners know there are some really fascinating discussions here of all of these genres, of the use of autobiography, of the use of correspondence, and as anecdotes, right? Or the use of anecdotes to create this pathology in different ways. And it's really, really interesting. So listeners
I'm happy to add something another thing that was really important actually while writing this chapter is that I realized how much the creating knowledge is really in the process of selecting the words and selecting the ways to talk about this knowledge, and that we cannot separate a content that would be delivered from the way it is delivered, and that doctors in the 18th century were extremely aware of that and really coined the illness and framed the illness and describe the illness by choosing specific ways to talk about it, and that we cannot separate the two. Yeah, I think that's one of the very important things in this book.
Absolutely, and I think the book makes that point really compellingly. And just kind of as a footnote, I think I totally agree with you, and I think this is one of the reasons why there's actually a lot of there's some really exciting work right now coming from and out of scholars who are using this as a kind of point of departure and bringing together media studies, right? Studies of media and form with STS and with history of science and medicine in exciting ways that really explore this kind of central point that you're just enunciating and elaborating right now. I think it's a really, really important point. And thank you so much for articulating that. So as we move from chapter 3 to chapter 4, we move into a chapter that looks at the description of fits, of vapors, of vaporous fits, to, as you put it here in the book, exemplify the relationship between body and mind, irrespective of medical concerns. Now, this chapter looks at the work of several authors from the Republic of Letters in order to, as you again put it here, consider contradictory conceptions of physiological phenomena. Now, so what I want to do here is, again, just kind of turn this over to you and ask you to talk about what you think is most interesting and exciting about this. And the first thing that I'd love to hear a little bit about is just this idea of vapors as an art, as a fashion. Hmm. So for you, can you talk a little bit about this and open this up for us? What's interesting from your perspective for us to understand about the way vapors and fits were practiced as a kind of art or a fashion in works in this period?
Yes, I mean, I think that one of the exciting things is that here at that point, we see a certain a certain code, a certain way to express emotion is gonna develop, and it's gonna frame and create the way people are gonna react to certain things, and then are gonna allow their body to react in certain contexts, knowing that they are watched, and at the same time with a very, very, very strong sense of what are the limits. It's not that boundaries disappear. It's not that in the 18th century you can do without the bienséance, but there are moments where you can play with them. And hysteric fits become a way to very silently, very cautiously play with those boundaries and reverse them up to a certain point where a woman is going to show parts, is going to have a fit and be so present that we might, you know, undo a little bit of her dress and we might see a little bit of her body, but you know, this will be forgiven, this will be accepted because this is an historic fit. It will be a moment where, you know, where everything is at risk, and at the same time, for it to work, people have to be very conscious of what they do. So there is this idea that it can allow emotion, and it can favor the manifestation of these emotions as long as these people are very, very confident and aware of what they are doing. So we're both in emotion and manipulation at the same time. Mm-hmm. And this, in a way, links to the history of emotion that has been developing in the last few years. Where are we in the field of emotion? Where are we in the one of pathology? When is it that a sensitive person is becoming a patient? Is it the moment when the doctor says she has become a patient? We're always in between.
Mm-hmm. Fabulous. Now, one of the things that's going to happen as we move further into the book is there's going to be a more increasingly explicit focus on narrative, the shape of narrative, the force of narrative, and the significance of narrative in creating this discourse. And this actually starts to happen here in this chapter 4, before we get to like chapter 5, which is all about narrative. And one of the ways that this happens is that you're looking specifically here, at least in some point of the chapter, at the essay as a narrative form, insofar as authors are using it to explore this idea of a practice of fits, or like vapors as an art or a fashion. And you look at a number of different authors. Diderot is one of them. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, sort of how are... there's actually a couple of different things that come up, at least, that are interesting about this. One is the use of the essay as a form for exploring this, and also your own practice, again, as an author, in bringing together, in this chapter and beyond, very, very different kinds of writings into a coherent body and making them speak to each other. So can you talk a little bit about what you might find interesting about that set of issues, essays specifically, and bringing together a very diverse body and making it into a coherent body for looking at this phenomenon?
Yes. There is this, I mean, one of the things that was really important for me was to really pin down the singularity of the 18th century of and through all this variety of writing, desire, I thought, to convey thought through narrative, through story, to have the reader think. And so to not give him what we would expect, or what we would now describe as a coherent, linear text where you know where you start and you know where you're going. But to play and to create this play with a reader where he's going to be surprised, in which he's going to be first thinking, well, maybe we're going, you know, this is the hypothesis, this is what this would demonstrate, and then go the other way around, because in the meantime, the text is created to having take the opposite opinion. So I think that one of the fascinating things of the writing of many of the writings of the 18th century is the way to create stories, to give, to never have a strict moral line, but to have the reader deduct moral ideas from what he will read. And this through what we have since classified as philosophical works or moral work or scientific works, we're always in between.
So as we, I mean, one of the really interesting things that happens as we continue that into the next chapter, and you really bring us into the importance and the increasing importance of narrative form from the 1750s onward in what you call here inscribing physiological disorders into a coherent progression, is that you take us into the importance and the role of narrative form in fiction. Right? And this chapter looks at a series of novels. It focuses on three novels in particular, in which, as you put it here, the body's manifestations appear as a code, as a truth, or as a manipulation. And this depends on the particular narrative demands of the author. So the three novels that you bring us into include a novel by Lennox, The Female Quixote, a novel by Godwin, Things as They Are, or The Adventures of Caleb Williams, and a novel by Diderot on a nun. So I would just love for you to say a little bit about to kind of describe for us if there's one of these that you are particularly interested in, right? The Lennox, the Godwin, or the Diderot. Do you have a favorite here? And would you mind just kind of picking an example and using it to exemplify the importance of this genre of fiction and of novels in particular to opening up this history and this moment in the discourse of hysteria for us?
Thank you. Yes, I will. I guess I'll take the Nun from Diderot because of the diversity of the perceptions of hysteria that it offers. We see in this and what one of the things that's interesting actually and that is particularly fascinating is that the word hysteria never appears in this book, and this I can't help always telling people at the time where we are, you know, where we have databases where everyone work with keywords, and yet we have the perfect descriptions of the hysteric fits as offered by Diderot's contemporaries. So, and his book could be seen as making a study of the different possibilities, the different types of crises that are gathered within the definition of hysteria. We see nuns at different moments of their lives and different emotional crises, and these bodies are presented as torn with convulsion and hitting the wall, or as fainting and forgetting even what they've experienced, as in ecstasy, as in moment of desire and nymphomaniac moments. So all these constellations of emotions are never interpreted as an illness. They're always presented to the reader for the reader to understand what are the emotions experienced by these characters. And the reader, by reading all these bodily manifestations, interprets that what kind of crisis these actors, these characters are going through, right? So doing so, I mean, we can see the literary uses of these and the literary interpretation of the same manifestations that are in a medical context seen as pathology. Suddenly the question is no longer if a person is sick or not, but simply what is she experiencing? And the body just So just there to reveal what the person thinks and feels. Mm-hmm. So there, I mean, this. I mean, I think that what it, this chapter is meant to indicate in a different way than chapter four is how much those are prisms of interpretation, and depending on which one, depending on the uses you can do of this interpretation and you want to do of this interpretation, the words you will use are different, and the interpretation will be.
Great, thank you. And so also in this chapter, just to signal this for listeners, there's also a really careful attention to physicians' observations. And you make a point here that in these observations, to cure is to find the story. The physician becomes a narrator, and you chart a difference in the writing, or a change, a transformation in the writing practices here from the early 17th century to the early 19th century, insofar as the writing practice transforms from a practice that prioritized handling as many cases as possible and arriving at a kind of general discourse to a writing practice that kind of lingers slowly over the details. Now, this becomes really interesting in terms of how you're engaging the work and the ideas of Foucault. Foucault comes up all over the book, right? This is one of the consistent interlocutors of the study, at least from the perspective of, you know, me as one reader. But here, one of the things that you're showing here in this chapter, and I'd really love to hear a little bit more about this, is that kind of not perhaps contra Foucault, but also maybe better put, a little bit different from what Foucault is showing, what develops in much medical writing over the late 18th century, and this becomes clear in this part of the book, is not so much a gaze, right, as listeners will have found in the work of Foucault in this period, but instead a form of narrative intelligence. So can you talk a little bit about that? What's significant about that shift between understanding this transformation as the emergence of a form of narrative intelligence rather than a kind of gaze?
Yes, thank you. I mean, I think that Foucault was indeed very, very important in first getting to this field of research, but also in the attention I gave to language and but to the point of willing to offer some other keys. I think that indeed defining and categorizing is one, but that there are many others that are developing in the 18th century, and narrative is one of them. Narrative is particularly important in the case of hysteria. I would say, first, in relation to what we mentioned earlier, the difficulty to offer a definition and the need to find a currency for the illness. But beyond even the question of hysteria, in a change in the interpretation of the pathology and of pathologies in general, in appropriating the illness to his patient. And so no longer looking at it from the outside, but really in creating a link between the biography, the morals, the emotions, the history of the patient, the place where he lived and the interaction he had or she had, and linking all these elements to what he felt, to what was then seen as a pathology. There we can see also the circulation, of course, of way of understanding between men of letters and doctors who adopt a way of talking about the modern subject in the late 18th century with the Bildungsroman, where the more and more attention is brought to the emotion, to the education, to the experience of the subject. I forgot what I wanted to.
That's great. Actually, that's great. So what we could actually move to now maybe, and if you think of anything else that you wanted to mention, we can totally just bring that up, whenever you want. But
it might come back later.
Sure. But as we move to the last body chapter of the book, chapter 6, we move to a story about transformations in the wake of the French Revolution. So this chapter considers how physicians are reframing their social and scientific status in the wake of the revolution. You argue here that this period saw the construction of, as you put it here, a new status for the doctor that emphasized his role and his power. And we see this in lots of examples in this chapter. One of the particularly fascinating examples is the example of mesmerism. Now, your understanding of the practice of mesmer actually importantly diverges from how other studies understand his practice. And because that's so important and because he's such a central figure in this period, and at least the historiography of science, I wonder if you couldn't talk a little bit about that. For you, what's most important about kind of understanding mesmer and mesmerism here, and what's importantly different in the way that you're understanding this given how lots of other studies do?
Yes, thank you. And this actually links to the previous question and what I wanted to say about it. I mean, I actually would favor narrative, the role of narrative, as the important step of the late 18th century in the building of a corpora on hysteria and of an interpretation of hysteria over the role of Mesmer. I mean, Mesmer has been highlighted, and as well as Puységur, because of their practices and especially because of somnambulism as a pre Charcot and Freudian therapy. And I think that what really is important for us, I mean, in the construction of history as a pathology that would be at the center of so many writing in the 19th century, is the space it gives for the patient, for his biography, and that this will indeed reappear a lot with psychoanalysis when medicine has become a space functioning in a what has been called objective manner, mm-hmm. where specific questions have to be raised and where questions do not so much depend upon patient any longer, and where there is the development of a uniform practice, then, you know, this create a space for and the need for something different, and this will be then taken on by psychoanalysis. And I think that we can see in the late 18th century, with the importance given to narrative, with the importance to linking emotions and crisis, a moment when that first really developed.
Great.
And I think that this takes over the importance of Mesmer in the creation of the pathology.
Wonderful. Now, as we move toward the conclusion of our conversation, we're actually going to move toward taking on a theme or a problem, a topic that actually is pretty common, right, in terms of how people think about hysteria, but that we haven't actually talked about explicitly. So I want to bring us there before we wrap up. And this is the connection between hysteria and women, right? Hysteria mm-hmm. and gender. Now, starting in the 1770s, as you show here in this chapter 6, physicians are describing hysteria as a dangerous symptom of modernity. There's a new focus here on the health of the nation's body, right? And you talk about this in really beautiful detail in this chapter. And it shifted the stakes of hysteric illness. This is in the words of the book. It was no longer, as a result, a diagnosis of the upper classes, but instead, as you show here, a diagnosis that facilitated a medical discourse on women. So as our kind of the final question to lead us into the conclusion, Sabine, can you talk about this? What's happening in this period that shifts the discourse specifically to this focus on women, and what's important for us to understand about that, in your opinion?
Yes, I think that there is a huge shift that happens after the French Revolution, and that this entails so many important things about the way we think about medicine, about the way the role of doctors is placed. As you've emphasized earlier, I mean, there is a development in the 18th century of medicine which is turned toward the aristocracy, with indeed all these writings that are also meant to be read by this elite or by the court as a whole. This is, in a way, the ideal patient at the time. After the French Revolution, of course, there is no longer a point in writing for the aristocracy, but there is a new big topic, which is the budding of the French nation. And this chapter is indeed dedicated really to France, as well as the other one on, also on England, over England a little bit. This one is really strictly on the French case. Why that? Because there is a development in France in those early years which cannot be seen in England at the same time, of those treatises on women and on hysteria as a illness for women. This will come only later in England. And why women? Because in the building of the French nation, what becomes important as a new French citizen. And to ensure that those French citizens are healthy and ready to go and fight to bring freedom all over the world, right? we need to make sure that pregnant women take care of their body and that they give birth to healthy citizens. And so there is a complete reframing of the pathology, of the patients that are supposed to be afflicted by the pathology, of the politics entailed with the pathology, since now it's going to be thought a lot more in terms of public health or in public morality or in education of women. And there is a shift also of the place of the doctor, which is now on the side of the nation, helping the state to think what is good for the years to come.
So, Sabine, thank you so much. If you can believe it, we've almost been talking for an hour. Now, even though, you know, we've been talking for an hour, there's, of course, a ton of material we haven't had a chance to get to. So before we wrap up, is there anything in particular that we haven't talked about pertaining to the book, but that you'd like to mention for listeners?
I mean, I guess I'll develop a tiny bit more the last point and just saying what is important for me there is that over a period of 150 years, I mean, which is the period which is mostly studied in the book between 1670 and 1820, what happens is that it's not the same approach that is developed to historic affection. It's not described in the same kind of books. It appears first in books for doctors. It appears then on books on nervous affection, then in nosologies, then in treatises on women. So these books are not read by the same kind of readers. I mean, we assist to a constant shift of what it is that is described, the way it is described, the purposes that are linked to it, the stakes that are involved in it. And yet, there is then this sense that in the 1800s that with this we have one pathology, and that, of course, this pathology is a pathology of women because the word is linked to the Greek root, and that it can only be an illness of women. So this book tries to really pin on, I mean, this fascination of what can be done while rewriting, citing and negotiating and reformulating over and over again the meaning, the relationship between fits, their association to specific political events, their association to a sensibility, their association to a gender. And how is it that this happens? So hysteria is a really an exemplary case to see how can we make meaning out of the body, how can we use it to talk about the relationship between body and soul, the relationship between different classes, the relationship between religious people, the relationship between anything that becomes at a certain moment important, anything that becomes revelatory of certain people or their ideas. This is one of the things that I've tried to describe.
Wonderful. And now that the book is out, Savine, what are you currently working on? What's currently inspiring you, and what are you researching now?
I'm actually now working on deafness. You will not be surprised, the fascination for medicine and the fascination for language has found its way.
Makes sense, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And this led me actually to work on the 19th century mainly, even though the 18th century will still be very present because I just miss it too much if I go away for too long. So, yes, history of psychiatry is still there, history of medicine, a little bit of legal history, a little bit of history of pedagogy. This needs to find its way.
Well, best of luck with that research. It also sounds fascinating. And be in touch when that comes out, and we'll talk about that too. But in the meantime, thank you so much for taking time out of that work to talk with me today.
It's helping me through the book and making me discover it again.
Thank you. You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks very, very much for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.